All right. It is my privilege to introduce the next guy. What a great guy this guy is, and I've gotten to know him over the last year, and he's helped a lot of people. So let's give it up for Elliot.
I'm Elliot, I'm an alcoholic. I think I should thank Bill for asking me to do this, so thank you, Bill. I apologize, I'm not wearing a tie. I'm sure my sponsor is not the happiest with me, but if I took fashion advice from him, I'd be wearing pink pants and a camouflage tux, but I'm really grateful to be here. My sobriety date is February 1st of last year, so I just got to celebrate a year last month. Oh, man. I don't want to talk too much about my drunk log, but, you know, if you want to know why I have three felonies and I'm not allowed back at College of the Sequoias until 2099, you can totally talk to me after the meeting. But I can assure you that's all connected with my drinking. I was one of those guys that I didn't always get in trouble when I drank, but every time I got in trouble, it was because of my drinking. You know, this isn't my first trip in AA. I sat through court-mandated meetings for a year, and I said, I'm Elliot, I'm not an alcoholic, you know, I just need to get my court card signed, and you know, you guys were really nice to me, man. You put up with it. I didn't know that you were going to see an open and a closed meeting, and, you know, I figured hats off to me after I'm done here, you know, that's about all I took from it. Once my court stuff was done, I was back to drinking 30 days later, set a whole bunch of rules for myself, broke all those rules, you know, the standard stuff, no Bud Light, no drinking and driving, no, you know, drinking by myself, no drinking in the morning, all that stuff, and I pretty much broke all those rules twice. Wound up back here on another DUI, and it's been quite the trip since my first meeting, man. I walked in, I went back to those meetings I went to, and I said, I was like, I'm not going to sit at the table, I'm not going to sit up front, you know, I'm going to go hide in the back corner. The room was full, the back corner was already full, there was one table, one chair. Someone pulled it out and said, this one's for you, and you know, that was the first time I admitted I was an alcoholic out loud, you know. I had a few people tell me, but, you know, that's how it is. But, so I'm here now. You know, I hear a lot, like, we're exactly where we're supposed to be, doing exactly what we're supposed to do. And, you know, I just don't believe that, you know, because I'm not supposed to be here. We're not supposed to be here, celebrating what we celebrate and doing the steps that we do. I mean, it's, what is it, Saturday night? And I'm here, you know, with all you guys. To me, that's one of the biggest differences. You know, I'm not supposed to care about other people. I should be practicing selfishness, you know, not these steps. I shouldn't be hanging out with some dude 2.5 times my age who's been sober longer than I've been alive, you know? That's just not what I'm supposed to be doing. and that's just what's happening, you know? I love that man, don't get me wrong. But is it hot in here? Is it? Okay, it's hot. Okay. Someone's going to have to wave at me when there's some time when I'm done. But let's see. You know, I came in here to stay out of prison. You know, I came in here with no license, no car, no job, no girlfriend, no credit score, and I still have not one of those things, okay? Don't get me wrong, but the things that I have gotten, I couldn't put a price on, and you couldn't score them, you know? I look across this room, and I know probably half of you by name. and I've got to spend at least a couple minutes here and there and learn something from each and every one of you, even Brett, you know. And to me, that's special. You know, I felt like it's been a year, but it feels like it's been like 4.5 months. And I don't know if that's good or bad, you know, but I take it as it is. And that's how I kind of live my life today. You know, everything hasn't been perfect. I've hit a few, roadblocks here and there in my sobriety. And when I talk to my sponsor, you know, when I finally do, after like 3 or 4 days of sitting in my own shit, you know, and I finally make that phone call or a text message or, you know, or I call my buddy Philip, you know, and complain to him. What I find out is that it was something that I didn't do. You know, I didn't wake up and I didn't do my daily meditations. I didn't sit in prayer. I wasn't practicing the steps, you know, those kinds of things. The fact that I'm able to look at myself and find my part and stuff is, to me, it's crazy. I mean, it's absolutely absurd that I'm doing that now, you know, because before I was right until I made you cry, until you apologized to me, you know, and to the point that you just gave in and said, you know what, fine, Elliot, have it your way. And I don't have to be that way anymore. You know, early on, my sponsor told me, he said, you know, you can be wrong and you can be right, but you can't be viciously right. And that's been a big change for me because I know everything, you know. And if you think you know everything, open up the big book, and I've used the dictionary more times in the last year than I did in high school, you know. And that's a really humbling experience. I never admitted that out loud, but, you know, that's what it's taken for me. I mean, I thought I was intelligent. That's what somebody told me my first time in AA. He was like, you know, I think you're an alcoholic, but you're probably too smart for your own good. And I took it as a compliment, you know. I was like, hell yeah, man, I agree, you know. I was like, I'm with you, you know, except for the alcoholic part, you know. And what he really meant was that I was too smart for my own good, and I missed the stuff that I was supposed to see. You know, I was very inquisitive. I thought that I had everything figured out. I thought the world was just a bunch of atoms smashing into each other, and whatever happened, happened, you know. And when I read the chapter to the agnostic, that was, you know, it really kind of broke me down and humbled me just a little bit more. And it taught me that I don't have to know everything, and everything that I think I know isn't what I know, and it's not fact, you know. And I've learned that I've had to be open to new ideas. When I came in, I thought that I was going to learn why I was an alcoholic. And I figured if I learned why, then I could change it and fix it and maybe give it another shot, you know. I'll clean up what my sponsor said to me when I asked him, why am I an alcoholic? He said, screw why. This is how. You be honest, you be open, and you be willing, and you show some gratitude, and you can work through this thing, you know. And I've had to really, really work. There's things that have come easy for me. The third step for me was the toughest thing I've ever done in my life. Fourth step, whatever, you know. That third step, that tore me down, and when I hit my knees, something changed that day. And if you're new, give it a shot, man. Even if you're not willing, if you're just willing to be willing, that's all it takes, I've learned. Because I didn't come in here for friends. I didn't come in here for spirituality. I didn't come here to stand up here and talk to you guys for hopefully 10 minutes, maybe more. I don't know. I didn't come in here for friends, none of that stuff. I did not want to know what was wrong with me, you know. That was the last thing, and then I didn't want to admit why. But I have, and it's been the greatest thing, man. I love you guys. You guys have treated me. You guys have loved me while I learned to love myself, because I came in here not loving myself at all, you know. I thought I was a bad person, trying to get good, and what you guys showed me was I was a sick person, and you were going to show me how to get well. And I'm really grateful for you guys. I'm grateful for tonight. I really hope I keep coming back, you know. And that's all I got. I'm Elliot, and I'm an alcoholic.
give Elliot one more round of applause. All right, I'm Nick. I'm an alcoholic. Once again, I'd like to thank everyone that came out tonight. And let's give a big welcome, a Visalia welcome to Amy F. from Glendale.
Back there. Hi, I'm Amy. I'm an alcoholic. Before I forget, I want to thank a lot of people. I don't want to make it more special than anybody else that is doing work here, but thank you to Bill and Suzanne for just being amazing hosts. My husband and I feel so taken care of since before we got here. It didn't used to be like that. So thank you. And thank you to Alcoholics Anonymous. And then thank you to everyone who has worked on this event. I hear it's get just successful year after year. And, that's impressive. And I love being in a room full of people who want to be here, people who are like super excited about their sobriety. I can't say that, I don't know, I think if, I don't know if it was the 60 day, but she stood up in the back and she was like, woo, like how we are at concerts. And I loved that. I couldn't even crack a smile at 60 days of sobriety. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I get really nervous. Suzanne asked me when I got here, like, are you nervous? And it's never good when I start to cry at the beginning of my share. Sorry. Doesn't bode well for the rest of the night. But and she asked me if I was nervous, and I told her, like, I never get nervous until, like, right before or a little bit before I know I have to get up there, because I'm here enjoying Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm enjoying. That was an amazing pitch, Monty, for H&I. And thank you, Elliot. That was amazing. I loved it, and I enjoy myself until I know, I have to participate. I always feel like I'm going to throw up, which hasn't happened yet, but if it did, it would look like brownies, and and it would be probably the best representation of what I used to be like, honestly. So my sobriety date is November 15th, 2002. Thank you. Woo! No, I'm just kidding. I'll just tell you what I was like, what happened to me, and what I'm like today. So I grew up in West LA. I am the only alcoholic that I know of in my family, but hereditary or not, I believe I was born an alcoholic. I had, those isms before I ever put alcohol into my body. What I can remember most about being a child, and a lot of what I see today is actually a result of, what I've learned being sober and Alcoholics Anonymous, and that inventory and that changing and that owning of my stuff. And if you would have asked me before I got sober or a couple of years into my sobriety, I would have told you that I had a horrible life, And I can tell you today that I had an amazing, blessed life. My parents are incredible people. They're generous and kind. I grew up in West LA. I went to this French school, that took me to France. And my parents, they worked really hard to give my brother and I a good, great opportunities. I had a great education. I had great experiences. I traveled. I learned things. We went to plays, and if you would, and I hated them. I hated my parents. And I never, I never liked myself. I never liked what I had. I didn't know what I had, you know. I didn't know until I met my husband at Alcoholics Anonymous that, like, everyone doesn't get a car when they turn 16, you know. And I was mad when I was 16 and I got a, you know, brand new Honda Civic. I wasn't grateful for that. You know, I didn't know how to be grateful until Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and not until I was sober, but until I had started to do steps, you know, and look at myself in Alcoholics Anonymous. But, you know, because all my friends were getting Beamers, you know, and Jeep Wranglers. That was the thing in the 90s. But, you know, and I got a Honda Civic, you know, with balloons in it. And what a horrible, you know, child. My parents worked so hard, you know, to give me those things. And you know, that's who I was, you know, before I even drank. That's who I was. My first drink was my first drunk. I was 14 years old. We moved to the Valley when I was 11, so that's why I sound like this. I felt so bad for the committee. I had to send, like, a recording of myself, and I'd never done that. And I tried to listen because I was like, well, I don't want to send, like, a sucky, you know, like a sucky talk. I don't know. So, and I couldn't listen to myself. It was too horrible. Like, I feel bad for my husband. He has to hear me talk, like, every day, all the time. especially when we're watching something on TV. So my first drink was my first drunk. I was 14 years old. It was before a homecoming dance. And it was vodka and orange juice in the park. And I puked and made out with my date and blacked out. And that is pretty much my whole drunk log. That's what happened to me. Every single time I took a drink, from my first drink to my last drink, was I was a puking, blackout, makeout drunk. And I never ever drank appropriately. You mentioned the Jekyll and Hyde. There's something in there. It's like, incredible tragic things happen every time I drank. And what is it in there? It's like dangerously, you're like normal, and then like you get a couple of drinks and you're like dangerously antisocial. Like that was the change, you know. That's what happened to me when I drank. And what alcohol did for me, you know, what I can say that it did for me, why I continue to drink, because it's not that, you know, puking and blacking out was so much fun, I wanted to keep doing it, you know, for a long time. But what alcohol did for me was I had, you know, grown up so I didn't like myself, you know. I felt like so painfully self-conscious all the time forever. I had always gone to school with, you know, all white kids, and my parents are mixed race, and I think that's probably one of the reasons, if I look at it, that I hated them. You know, it's like, look at you, you made me different. You know, I can look back today and see, you know, how brave they were. You know, my mom's family, like, wasn't accepting of their marriage at the time, and you know how it was courageous for them to, you know, wouldn't have ever had that thought, you know. It was just like, look at you, you made me look different from all the other kids, you know. And I just always, you know, people, I don't know, when people talk about that exposed nerve, like, that's how I relate, you know. That's, you know, that, like, anything, like a puff of air would have, like, hurt me, you know, like a look, or just always thinking about myself, not necessarily, like, in a grandiose or great way, but just, like, do I look okay? Is this okay? Am I okay? And, like, having that thought all the time, all the time, all the time, and I think, no wonder I reached out for alcohol, you know, because what alcohol did for me at first was it just took all that fear away. All that, am I okay? Is this okay? Am I okay? Is this okay? Like, alcohol made it go away, and instead it was replaced with, like, I'm okay. This is okay. You're okay. I'm okay. Life is good, you know? And that's what alcohol did for me for a very short time. I was not an appropriate drinker. My drinking caused a lot of problems for other people right from the get-go. My drinking always negatively affected anybody that was around me, you know. And it could have been, you know, like, I can't, my friends, and I didn't drink all the time in high school because I couldn't. If I could have, I would have, you know. But I remember, from the very beginning, like, alcohol was my purpose, you know, going to a party. My friends might have wanted to go to a party, you know, for boys or for music or for whatever. Oh, I'll have to go to the bathroom if I drink both of these, but thank you. It was always, you know, it was always number one, you know, it was always my purpose. And, you know, my friends never had a good time when they went out with me because I always got insanely drunk, you know. Never mildly intoxicated, always insanely drunk. I love that. Because I was, I had that personality change, you know, and I just, was reckless and didn't care. And I remember going out in Hollywood and, you know, my friends couldn't have fun because they had to, like, keep me from, you know, getting into a van full of strange men, you know, and that's the things they had to do. Or I would agree to be the designated driver and then I would get drunk, you know, and not, I would never think about, like, oh, how is this affecting you? Oh, you wanted to get home alive? Okay, you know. I didn't have that ability, you know, before Alcoholics Anonymous. And actually, a couple of years into Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not have the ability to think about how my behaviors were affecting other people, you know. And so very quickly, because of my drinking, I hurt a lot of people. I said a lot of things, you know, that couldn't be taken back. I, you know, cheated on my boyfriends. I, you know, made out with my friends' boyfriends. I just didn't behave right, and I did a lot of things that were inappropriate and that hurt people, you know. And I started to rack up all these things, right? And I lied and I stole. And I know, and I think Elliot was talking about it, that, you know, I know I'm not an evil person. You know, I didn't enjoy doing those things, but alcohol worked to suppress the feelings that came from that, you know. So if I hurt you or said something to hurt you or stole from you, I didn't have to feel the, you know, effect of that. You know, alcohol helped to suppress it so that I could continue to do what I was doing. And alcohol, and I was not a functional person, so I knew I was an alcoholic a long time before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that first step, you know, I knew I was powerless over alcohol way before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew I was powerless because I could not drink, you know. I wasn't, you know, in denial about that. I knew that there were times that, you know, it was not appropriate to be drunk, like on a job interview or, you know, driving anywhere. And I remember when my grandfather died, my father had asked me, you know, he wanted me to be there because I'm part of the family. And he asked me if I could not drink, if I could show up sober. And I, of course, was, like, offended, you know, like, by the question. And I couldn't, you know, I couldn't. And I couldn't say, like, no, I can't, you know. I was just like, how dare you? And then I showed up drunk, you know. And I knew I was powerless over alcohol. And I knew my life was unmanageable because I wasn't a functioning person when I drank. And I still, like, used to see, you know, when women would come into the meetings and they'd have, like, a nice purse or a nice car or something, I'd be amazed. I'd be like, wow, you still have stuff, you know? I wasn't, like, you should stay, you know, if you want to keep that nice purse. But I couldn't keep a job. I couldn't not crash my car. I couldn't not get evicted. I couldn't keep relationships. I was, you know, an insane person, and I couldn't function normally. So I knew I was powerless over alcohol. I knew my life was unmanageable, but I continued to drink, you know, because I needed to drink, you know, and it was kind of the only thing that mattered, you know. And so my parents had tried to help me. I think I was 24 when they sent me to my first rehab, and it was a 28-day program, and it's not that it was a bad program, it was just I didn't want to be sober, so it didn't work, you know. And it was nice, you know. And I went because my parents were letting me live there, and it was they weren't going to let me continue to live at their home because I couldn't live on my own. And I had, you know, been so psycho and crazy that I couldn't get a guy to, you know, like, you know, float me, you know, put a roof over my head anymore either. Cause that used to be my way. You know, I would just find someone to take care of me. And I didn't know any of the stuff about myself. Even at 12 years of sobriety, I had to do another big inventory, and these things, you know, just like came up to like bite me in the ass again, you know? And it's like, I didn't know that this was, you know, and I can see when I think back, like, oh my gosh, you know, what was I thinking? You know, that I could just show up to the world and be like, hi, I'm Amy, take care of me, you know? And that's what I was doing. I never learned how to take care of myself. And so I needed people to take care of me. And by take care of me, I mean like, you know, pay for me and the things that I want and need, you know? And it was easy to do that before my drinking progressed, because I was still coherent and I could still, you know, manipulate, and I could still, you know, figure out what you wanted and make that bargain. And a lot of times that came with a lot of compromise, you know, and, you know, that's just one more thing for me not to feel good about, right? To cover up with that alcohol. But then I was starting to lose that ability because I couldn't function. And you know, alcohol wasn't doing anything for my looks. And I remember what it felt like when someone would, like, when you can feel, I don't know, I can't speak for guys, but I can speak for, well, me. I don't want to offend any women by, like, lumping you in with my craziness, but I could feel when someone, my meal ticket was slipping away. Like, I knew when it was going to happen, right? And I that fear, that panic, that, like, utter panic at, oh my God, you know, I need this person, you know, and then I would do something like insane. When it never went my way. No one ever stayed. Like, maybe they walked away slower and more carefully. But no one ever stayed, you know, like saying you're going to kill yourself, like if someone leaves, like, isn't a good, you know, it's not a good sale. So, you know, my parents were the last, you know, and anyway, they were like, you can't drink anymore. So I went to this 28-day program and I had fun. You know, I was like, I ate frozen yogurt and I played ping pong and I fraternized. And then I left there with a $40,000 big book on my parents' dime, and I stayed sober for 4 days. And then I drank again. I hit another bottom. I dragged my parents through more hell and more pain. And then they put me in a 90-day program in Simi Valley. And I complied and I got through that program too. I was good at getting through programs, you know, because I, you know, could say what I needed to say and do what I needed to do. I didn't have anything, you know, going on outside. So what I did for 90 days was I fraternized, essentially. I had like 3 boyfriends in 90 days. And some of them already had girlfriends and fiancés. But I didn't have any principles before Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had no ability to think outside myself of other. And so I completed that program, and on the day I left, I got loaded. And the guy I was seeing, like, came and picked me up, and we went to a motel, and I love this. This is like, I love how in the book it calls it like a peculiar mental twist. I think that's a really cute way to put it, you know, because it's just batshit insanity. But they were trying to be dainty. I don't know. I think only like 1 or 2 women were involved in the writing, but it's peculiar. So he had a different drug of choice than me. And my thought was like, oh, I'll do your drug of choice because I've never done it before and it's not a relapse, you know? But I did his drug of choice and I didn't like it. And then, you know, like 30 minutes later, you know, I made him go down and get me some alcohol. And then I was just living in Simi Valley, living off the good graces of the nice people in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, who all they want to do is like help you to have this beautiful gift that they found, right? And I was just, you know, living in rooms and hitching rides and showing up at meetings, and I was doing all of it drinking, you know, and I was stealing from them, and I was taking, you know, And that's what I did. And I was living in Simi Valley when I finally, I think, conceded to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic, because I always knew I was an alcoholic. Knowing I was an alcoholic, wasn't enough for me not to drink, you know? But what happened is alcohol stopped working, you know? And, it stopped covering up all those feelings of shame and guilt and, you know, more than anything, like disgust. I was so disgusted with myself, for the things I was doing, and like the person that I knew I was supposed to be, the person that I knew I could have been, you know, like the track I was like set forth on, you know, and the things I was doing and the people I was hurting, and just, I was so disgusted with myself, you know, and alcohol had stopped. I was living in Simi Valley when alcohol stopped covering those feelings up, and all I felt every day was disgust and shame, you know, and I couldn't live that way anymore. And you know, again, I had been going to Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't one of those people that didn't believe you when you said you were, you know, happy, joyous, and free, and talked about the promises, and I believed all that, you know. I didn't want it, you know. So when I conceded to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic, I thought, well, I'm an alcoholic, and that means I can't drink. You know, I had that understanding. And I love in A Vision for You where it talks about the jumping off point. It says, you know, there will come a day when man can't imagine life either with or without alcohol. Then he will know loneliness such as few do. He'll be at the jumping off place. He'll wish for the end, something like that. And that's exactly what happened to me, was when I realized I couldn't drink anymore. I didn't want to live, you know, without alcohol. And I very specifically didn't want to live in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? So, I had a plan. I was living in Simi Valley at the time. My parents were out of town. I knew that they were out of town on vacation. We had a dog who had epilepsy. So my dog took, you know, barbiturates to treat that. And I knew, you know, where they were because I also used to take them. And, it was in that peculiar mental twist again. So one time, there was like another prescription for my dog, like, and I was like, score, you know? So I took that, and my throat swelled up and I almost died. I had to go to the ER and they saved me. And when I got back to my parents' house, I remember like writing down the name of that particular medicine so that I would know not to take it again. I guarantee you, if another bottle with my dog's name on it like didn't match that one, you know. I remember, you know, speaking of like third steps, I had done a third step with a sponsee in like we said the prayer on our knees in a Starbucks bathroom, and the floor was like so nasty, and there was like this pill with his hair, and I just remember thinking like I would have totally eaten that hair pill, you know, like off. I would have been like, score, you know. And like I used, you know, if I found, I used to live in Santa Cruz. I did my undergrad in Santa Cruz, and like I would find, you know, I know this is the meaning of Alcoholics Anonymous, but bags of other things. And I'd be like, score, and then, you know, it just put it in my body, you know. So I knew my parents were gone. I knew those pills were there. I knew I didn't want to live without alcohol, you know. So I had a plan. And at the time, I was living in Simi Valley, dating my sponsor's stepson. And I was 27 and he was 19. And I was like two bottles of wine into the night, and he dumped me. He's like, I love you, but you're crazy. And that's how all my relationships used to end. Like, I love you, but you're crazy. And I always say this, when my husband and I started dating, he's like, anyone that knows him, he's like Mr. Friendly, and he's like friends with every girl he's ever known. And when we started going out, I was like, you don't have to. And when we started dating, like, all his friends were girls. And I was like, you don't have to worry about any of that with me. Like, I crazied everybody away. Like, no one is going to look for me. And it's true. Nobody, nobody in 16 years has looked for me. And I just hear, like, my first sponsor's voice in my head, God's projection, God's protection. So I'll just go with it. But yeah, so he dumped me, and then I did that woman thing. I said, like, let me out of the car right now, and he did. And it was best thing he ever could have done for both of us, probably. But it was a dirt road in Simi Valley, and I had $60 in my pocket and a plan. So I called a cab, and he got a ride to my parents' house, and I had to break into my parents' house because I was no longer welcome there. So I crawled through the dog door, and I remember getting stuck. And that dog door, as a result of being sober, I am welcome in my parents' house, and that dog door's still there. And when I see it, I think, like, willing to go to any lengths because it's so small, you know. And, like, I mean, it took me a while, but I got through it because I got in there. Like, I don't even think I could get my head through there. And I keep telling myself, I'm going to try and freak my mom out. And I was going through the dog door again. But I remember getting stuck because I remember thinking, how dare they? You know, how dare they make me break into my own house, you know, like a dog. And I got into that house, and I got to those pills, and I always like to stress that my plan was good. You know, that pill bottle was very full. And I took, like, I think I remember leaving like 7 pills left for the dog, but I took a handful of those pills, and I went down to the den, and, you know, I fully expected never to wake up again, you know. And God was working in my life a long time before I acknowledged him or allowed him to, because my adult brother, who didn't live there, was at the house, and he called 911. And I used to say he wasn't supposed to be there, but I think about my life in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think he was, you know. And I still, you know, I've never had a conversation with him. I don't know what he was doing there, you know, but I'm so grateful that he was. You know, because when I think about, you know, it was 3 years sober with my parents giving me a cake at the, you know, at this meeting, when I realized, like, oh, you know, how selfish. Like, I tried to kill myself in their den while they were on vacation, you know, and my pain would have been over, you know, and they would have come home and found me. And I've heard people share, you know, about finding, you know, their loved ones who committed suicide, and that pain, you know, that doesn't go away for them. And I'm so grateful, you know, that my parents, that it didn't have to be that way for them, you know. So I woke up in ICU, I don't know how many days later, and when I opened my eyes, my first thought was, F you, God. And I didn't have a relationship with God before Alcoholics Anonymous. I believed in God because I was raised a certain way. And I can tell you exactly where we parted ways was I dropped out of confirmation when I was 15. And my thought was just like, well, there's God and his people, and there's me and smart people, and, like, that's just the way it's going to be. So I believed in God, but we didn't have a relationship, you know. But I love in We Agnostics where it says, deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. Because when I opened my eyes and realized I wasn't dead, I knew it was God's fault. And my first thought was, F you, God, you know. And that's what needed to happen, you know, for me, to just stop, I guess. So what happened was, like, when I cleared medically, they kicked me up to the 6th floor at All of You Hospital, which is the psych ward. And I remember getting up there and getting to a payphone and calling my dad and saying, like, hey, you need to come get me. These people are crazy. I don't belong here. And all I heard was click. And then a voice in my head, which today I know was God because it never would have come from me, said, you did this. You know, you made your bed, now you lie in it. And I was there on that psych ward for 10 days. And it wasn't because I was any crazier than anyone else. It was because I didn't have a place to go. My parents were done. And I didn't have anywhere to go. And I didn't have any money. I didn't have any insurance. But there was a social worker there, and he always wanted to talk to me. And I remember, like, complaining, be like, oh, he always wants to talk to me. Why does he want to talk to me all the time? And he was trying to place me, you know, like I had better things to do. I'm pretty sure I was trying to fraternize. Because you can fraternize anywhere. I know they say AA is the bottom of the barrel. But anyway. So I remember when he found some places for me to go. And he's like, hey, I found these two rehabs. There's one in Santa Monica and there's one in Sylmar. And I said, well, I want to go to Santa Monica, you know, because I like the beach and I like surfers and there's a two-story Anthropology. And I'm just full flight from reality. You know, I didn't have, like, thinking about Anthropology and, like, I don't have money or insurance or I have nothing, you know. I guess I was thinking I could meet a surfer who would buy me Anthropology. But thank God that it didn't go that way. So he's like, okay, that place has a bed tomorrow, but this other place has a bed today. And I just wanted to get out of there. So I was like, fine, I'll go to the one in Sylmar. And I was already in Sylmar. So, you know, once again, God was working for me before I acknowledged him or allowed him to. It was a six-month all-women's recovery home in Sylmar. And that is where my life changed. It closed down last year because the owner died. But oh my God, I'm just one story, you know, of so many women and mothers, you know. It was a magical place, but and I hated like every minute I spent there. But that's okay. You know, that's okay if you like hate being here. Like I can't believe some of you have been here all day doing steps. Congratulations. It's the best thing you could do, you know, and like you don't have to enjoy it. Thank God, you know. Thank God they don't force us to enjoy it, you know. Like no one would get sober. So I remember getting there, you know, and I remember this woman coming up to the gate, like, "Hi, I'm your big sister. We're gonna love you till you love yourself." And I just remember thinking like, whatever, you know. I honestly felt, and I'll never forget how I felt when I got to those gates. I felt like it was, you know, like the game's up, you know, the jig is up or whatever. I don't know. I don't think that's how I talk to myself, but, you know, I honestly felt like taking those pills was like the last good idea I had. I didn't have anything better than that. God wins, you know, my punishment. I felt like this is my penance, you know, and that's how I walked into that recovery home. And that's how I walked into my home group of Alcoholics Anonymous was like, this is my penance. This is my punishment for all the things that I've done. You know, this is God punishing me. But I accepted it. You know, it wasn't graceful and I wasn't grateful for sure. But I accepted, you know, that, okay, this is my life. You know, this is what I guess I'm going to live here, you know, and do stuff. And I go to meetings and read and chores. I'm lucky that they let me stay, honestly. I remember them saying something like, oh, you don't have any clothes? Because I walked into that place with like a plastic bag full of arts and crafts I had made at the mental hospital. And I still thought I was better than everybody else because I went to college. And I didn't know that this is the place I needed to be because these people told me, you know, the truth, you know. They love me enough to tell me the truth early on, you know, and I guess I talked about like how I went to college, and I don't know if I actually said how that makes me better than you, but that was the underlying message, I guess. And I remember them early on telling me like, oh, you went to college? Oh, you graduated Phi Beta, whatever. How's that working out for you? And they really knew how to like take me down a notch, and I needed that. And I realized, you know, I probably like put that out there, and I, oh my gosh, I wasn't doing anything worse. I remember calling my sponsor like from the phone and being like, oh, there are hookers here. And she was like, she's like, so what have you done? And she hung up on me. And then I was like, oh, I just kind of gave it away for free. But But they let me stay there, you know, and they told me, like, here we do Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, if you don't like it, you can kick rocks. That's what they used to say. And they called it kicking rocks down Polk Street because the house was on Polk Street. And I would picture myself, like, kicking rocks, like, leaving and kicking rocks because I didn't have anything. Like, I didn't even have 35 cents to put in a payphone. That's how I realize now how I date myself. Like, there were payphones. And they cost 25 cents and then 35 cents. But I wouldn't have had anyone to call, because at this point, nobody would have accepted my call, you know? And so I stayed at this place and I did what I was, you know, I did what I was told, and somewhere along the way, something changed for me, you know? And I remember, you know, and it was, I got a sponsor, and it was the same thing. It was the same lady, my big sister, and she's like, why don't you ask her to be your sponsor? And my sponsor was like, yeah, I'll be your sponsor. My early memories of Alcoholics Anonymous are just people that are, like, so happy. Like, yeah, I'll be your sponsor, you know? And I hated it so much. And, like, now, when I see, like, new girls, like, I'm always, like, super attracted to the one who looks so miserable, who's, like, rolling her eyes and, like, that's who I was, you know, and so I always make sure to go up to that girl and be like, hi, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and, like, super happy, so I did, I asked this lady to be my sponsor, and then I just did what I was told. I was good at doing what I was told, and I really didn't have anything to lose by not being as honest as I knew how to be at that time, you know, and what happened was, and, you know, these girls, I don't know if anyone's in a recovery home now, or was it, but we'd have these morning meetings and we'd read and we'd check in and stuff. And I remember the girls in the house, after they did their third steps, would come in and like talk about this amazing change, you know, and spiritual stuff. And that didn't happen to me after I did my third step, but, you know, I kept plugging along, you know, because I didn't want to be homeless. And I just, you know, kept doing the deal. And what happened to me was I did that fourth step and then I shared it with my sponsor in that fifth step. And I remember, like, I gave her, like, these two little ticky-tack things that I knew a bunch of people did, and then I called it, like, dropping the bomb, you know? I had this one thing that I had done that I thought made me the most horrible person in the world, and I was never going to tell anyone, you know? And I remember telling her, and she was like, oh, so? I know a bunch of people that did that. And I felt like, it just, you know, and then after that, I just let it all go. I just let it all rip, you know, and she was amazing, and I think for the first time, I felt a presence, you know, the presence of God, something, you know, and then I immediately went back to that recovery home and did that sixth and seventh step. I was alone in the yard. It was cold. I had a blanket on, and I remember saying that seventh step prayer, like, over and over and over again. My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad, you know, good and bad. And then I felt really close to God for the first time in my life. And I felt like, and, you know, in time since, you know, because the longer I stay sober, you know, it's just like, I think about steps 2 and 11, like, my relationship with my sponsor was, I didn't know her, you know, and it just started, she'd be like, just call me. And if you don't have anything to say, like, I'm calling you, you know, and I would call her and say, I'm calling you, and, like, hang up, because I had nothing to say. I didn't know her. And then what it turned into was like, hi, I hate this girl, you know, and then I would talk about some girl I hated in the house, or like, oh my God, I hate Barney and Angela, you know, and it was all like, I hate everything, right? And then it turned into, like, this amazing relationship, you know, because then I shared my fourth step with her, and she knew everything, and she still loved me and accepted me, and then, you know, she was there for me. Like, every time I called her, you know, like, it grew into this amazing relationship, unlike any relationship I have ever had or still, you know, do have. I have a new sponsor now, but it doesn't matter. You know, that's kind of like how my relationship with God was I just started praying because they told me to start praying. And I would get down on my knees and be like, I'm praying. You know, and then there was a speaker I heard when I was new, and she'd say, just be polite, you know, like, ask God, you know, please help keep me sober at the beginning of the day. And then at the end of the day, say, you know, thank you. Just say please and thank you. And I could do that. You know, I went to, like, you know, etiquette school. So I could say please and thank you. You know, and then what happens as I learned how to live sober and learned how to kind of, you know, apply the steps in my life was that relationship with God got stronger, you know, and I walked through things, you know, that were painful or disappointing or, you know, happy or whatever, you know, life stuff, feelings. And the more that I learned how to rely on that God and what that looked like and what it still looks like, I guess, but what it looked like early on was just like not drinking, you know, like how do I put my trust into action is like I don't pick up a drink, you know, and then, you know, by extension, like don't kill myself if I trust God. I mean, I had this Esther, my grand sponsor, I guess, used to tell me, like, you say you trust God, so do you, you know, and I have to look at, like, do I trust God? And so, and it started with that 7-7 in the time since, when I've been in pain or suffering and I've asked God to remove that, you know, I've learned how to do that. And I felt God like a blanket, you know, like comforting, you know, that is what God feels like to me. And so that was the turning point for me. I remember from that moment on thinking like, I can do this, you know, I can do Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I didn't have any like hopes and dreams like when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. One thing I love is like when you've had the same home group for your whole sobriety, people and your birthday is like coming around or someone hasn't seen you for a while, they like to like bring up like things that you used to say when you were like brand new. And so like when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, people would, you know, because they're interested and they want to get to know you, they'd be like, well, what do you want to do? And I was like, I would tell them like my goal in life, my singular goal in life before Alcoholics Anonymous was that I wanted to be Mrs. Kobe Bryant. Because I wanted to be a rich, drunk wife with floor seats to Laker games. And like that was my for real goal in life, was to be someone's wife, you know? And like to me it was like that's the ultimate guy that can give me stuff. But you know, and people would say like, oh, do you know him? And I'd go, no. What does that have to do with anything? You know, and I think about like, oh, I'm so grateful for the people that were patient with me when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. They let me stay. You know, my sponsor would be like, they're going to clap anyway, no matter what you say. But I kept coming back, and at that seventh step, oh, God, like one of our old-timers used to call me, like, Miss 90210, and I thought that was a compliment. When I was drinking in college, my friends used to call me Courtney Love, and because I was always battered and bruised, because that's what my drinking looked like that's what a Friday night looked like, and I thought that was a compliment. Like I was like, yeah, she's like a rock star, like she was gross in the 90s. But you know, just that, you know, that alcohol is like, it protects me, you know, from like running away from it. It was like me in a relationship. But so funny. I remember he used to call me Miss Lyo too, and I was like, yeah. I don't know what he meant by it. But yeah, so after that seventh step, that's when I committed to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said, I can do this. And then what became like, okay, like, oh, what I accepted, I started to really like Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got really involved, and I did those commitments, and then I started to love Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I was completing that that recovery home at 6 months, my sponsor was huge on foundation, you know, and very early on she told me the story of the three little pigs, and she said, you know, you can build your house with straw, you can build it with sticks, or you can build it with bricks, you know, because one day the big bad wolf is going to come and blow your house down, and you want it to still be standing. And so after I completed that 6 months, I went on staff at the home. I didn't want to go on staff. I was like the resident that was like, the staff are such losers, like they don't even get paid, you know, because I had no concept of what being a maximum service was. But they saved my life by asking me to go on staff, because I wasn't like ready for the world. I wasn't employable. I couldn't be in a relationship. I would have gone down the road to the San Fernando Hall and hooked up with some, you know, guy. I don't want to say loser because I was kind of a loser. So, and you know, it just wouldn't have ended. It would have the same cycle. Something would have happened. You know, I don't know if God would have let me die then either, but I went on staff and it saved my life. And then I went to their sober living and I lived there for a year and I didn't want to do that either because you had to sign in and out, you know, for where you were going and to get a meeting card signed at meetings. You had to go be of service at the recovery home 3 hours a week. And I did that too. And then I lived with my sponsor for a year. And, you know, I didn't want to do any of those things when I was, and, like, I would be on staff and these women would be completing the program at 6 months and going out into the world and, you know, getting like boyfriends and having babies and they'd come with like, they'd have cars and jobs and shopping bags and Starbucks. And I was like at this recovery home, like asking my mom to like buy me magazines and, taking the bus. And I was so bitter, you know, and I would tell my sponsor like, you know, I'm busting my ass and I don't have any of these things, you know. Like I'm laying bricks and those pigs are having fun, you know? And she said, you know, what kind of sobriety do you want, Amy? And I was like, I want good sobriety, you know? So I just kept plugging along, you know? And, I can tell you that today, a lot of those women that I was jealous of, are out. Some are in, some are out, and they've come in and out, in and out. And some of those kids that I was jealous of, like those kids have been dragged, you know, through their in and out, in and out. Some of them don't have those kids anymore. You know, some of them lost those kids. And some of those women are in jail. One of them was a young woman that I used to like, you know, tattle on when I lived at Sober Living with her. Cause I'd be like, she said she was at this meeting and I was at that meeting and she wasn't at them. That was like my spiritual pride years. another lesson. But you know, she hit a man, she got loaded and killed a guy, you know, and went to jail. And some of those women are dead, you know, and I haven't been sober all that long, but I've been sober long enough to see women, young women die, you know, and not pretty. One of them, I remember, got kicked out of the house. I don't even know what for. And then I heard like maybe 8 months later that she had frozen to death on Sepulveda Boulevard, you know, and I'm here, you know, and I'm so grateful for good sponsorship. And for like really having nothing else out there, you know, my first 2 or 3 years of sobriety, I complained about all the stuff I didn't have. And, I worked in treatment, up until, recently when it like burned down. But, I, you know, what I could see, I didn't like working there. So that's why I'm like, God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. I was too afraid to not have a job and money, but he just, you know, was like, here, I'll take this off your plate. Yeah, so I worked in treatment and people didn't have, what I found was like people had lives to go back to, you know, they had like FMLA and stuff like that, like pays, you know, and but you have to go back, like they had like a job and or they had children they had to go back to, or you know, they just had responsibilities and all the things I complained about and like, they didn't have, you know, like I didn't have that, you know. What I had was like this incredible gift of learning how to live sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. That was my whole life. That's all I had to do, you know, and that was what I did. I just learned how to be sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then in God's time, my world started to get bigger, you know, and I did go back to school, you know, and get a master's degree when I had 4 years of sobriety, you know, and I did, thanks. And, you know, I did find a good relationship. I mean, my relationships didn't get any better, like, early on in sobriety, but I wasn't the problem for the first time, you know, and thank God for good sobriety, too, because, you know, I knew where I needed to be on Wednesday nights, you know, and when that relationship went bust, you know, and it wasn't pretty, and I lost a lot, and my pride was hurt, like, I stayed sober, you know, because my foundation was made out of bricks, you know, and I could survive a break. Up. And I could survive job loss. You know, I've been unemployed twice in sobriety. But I met my husband in Alcoholics Anonymous. We at a GSR assembly. And I remember thinking, Besides, wow, he's handsome. But I remember thinking, wow, he must love Alcoholics Anonymous because he is a GFR. And why else would you do this? But, you know, and we have a good, we got married in Hawaii 10 years ago. And we have, you know, and it's not perfect, you know, marriage is work. What I've come to find is like things are work. You know, I used to think, I told the girls I sponsor that, you know, you think it's, I kind of used to think of it as a checklist, like get married, check, get a master's degree, check, have a kid, check. And like, it's not like after the check, it's like, wow, okay. Now I have to do stuff. And I mean, that's life. That's what I did. Know, you know, and we both love Alcoholics Anonymous, and we have principles. We live by principles, you know, and it allows us to get through things, you know, to not run away, to not say things we don't mean, you know, to take that moment away to like call a sponsor or pray or whatever, and to like look at myself, you know, and that is how I'm able to like rightly relate to people. I don't know, somewhere in the 12 and 12 it talks about how alcoholics like could never just rightly relate to other people, and it's because we were so like selfish and self-centered. So when you come into a relationship and it's all like selfish, like of course you're like not going to get along in the world. And I didn't know these things, you know, I didn't know that I didn't know how to take care of myself. And so 8:30, okay, I don't have that much more. So I mean, what I can say is like I learned how to live sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and then the world started to get bigger. You know, I got married, we had children, you know, I've gotten jobs and lost jobs, and like I just finished another master's degree because I was like, I don't like my other job, I'm gonna find a different job. And it's just been insanity. But the one constant, and a friend of mine, Tammy, always says, you know, life goes like this, but Alcoholics Anonymous has to be the constant. And I can say that Alcoholics Anonymous is the constant in my life. You know, I used to think of it like Jenga. It's like the piece that does, that can't move, you know, or everything else falls in. And I know like in the spiritual experience, it talks about those three essential things, like willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness. But in A Vision for You, it talks about like in order for whatever to come to fruition, I'm the worst like quoter of the big book, but but what it doesn't matter. Like what matters is like how what it means inside of me and how it comes out in my actions. But it talks about in order to consummate, I remember that word, this thing, this deal is, it takes like willingness, patience, and labor. And that is what I relate to. That has been my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, is I've been willing, you know, my willingness grows because I have a lot to lose today. And I love my life in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm willing, more willing than ever, to do what I need to do to stay sober, you know. And it's not painful anymore. Most of it isn't stuff that I don't want to do. It's actually like a luxury and a gift when I get to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, because my life has gotten real busy, you know. Patience, because I had to wait. You know, I had to wait for those things. And I'm so grateful because we've had the opportunity to watch people get things real fast and not have that foundation to be able to hang on to them, you know. And I'm grateful. When we were trying to have a kid, it wasn't happening, you know. I think we were both kind of on the same wavelength. I'm like, well, if it doesn't happen, I just want like four dogs, you know, and that's fine. That equals. But, you know, it was kind of hard month by month when it wasn't happening. And I remember thinking, like, how funny is it, like, when you're, you know, a teenager and you're like, please, please, please don't be pregnant. And then, like, when you're trying, you're like, oh, I'm not pregnant, you know, how it shifts. You know, but after a year, I did get pregnant. And when we were, you know, trying to co-parent this baby, I remember thinking like, oh my, you know, once again, God knew what he was doing. You know, we needed that year to learn how to be married to each other, because that baby would have broken us, you know, if we didn't learn how to, if we didn't start building a foundation in marriage, you know, before we had that baby. And I got those degrees when I was able to suit up and show up and learn how to be part of a team and not be competitive, you know. And God was taking care of me again. My work burned down. And I was unemployed again, but I had been unemployed in sobriety before, you know, and I got through it. God took care of it then, and I had less fear this time around, you know, and I just plugged away, and I had these last 4 weeks of school, and it was miraculous because I wouldn't have been able to do that, to turn in that work if I had my job, you know. And then the day I turned in my last assignment, I got a call, and then it was like a Thursday, and then on Friday they called me and set an interview for Monday. I went in on Monday, and then on Thursday after my interview they offered me a job, you know. And and you know, Alcoholics Anonymous stayed the same. I did the same thing, you know. And it's easier to trust God the more you do it, you know. And I'll close with this. I will share, you know, I was 27 when I tried to kill myself. I am 43 now. In the 16 years I've been sober, my team has won the Super Bowl twice. The first time they won, I felt so much joy, and my first thought was like, I can't believe I tried to kill myself. Like, I would have missed this. And then they won 2 years later, and on this, like, amazing play, and I was like, I can't believe I tried to kill myself. Like, I would have missed this. The greatest play in Super Bowl history. And and then the next year they went to the Super Bowl again and they lost, and I was like, I want to die. And I really did. But I, you know, have a bigger, higher power than an NFL team. And then, you know, I love Elton John. My husband took me to see him 1 year, and we had like really good seats. And I remember telling him, you know, oh, I hope he sings my favorite song. I hope he sings my favorite song, because he doesn't always sing it. And he sang my favorite song, and he said it was his favorite song. And I turned to my husband and I was like, I can't believe I tried to kill myself. Like, I would have missed this moment, you know. And then honestly, like, you know, our kids, I would have missed that. And they're with their grandparents. Thank you for inviting us again. We, like, if anything, like, are like a night away from our children, who are a great blessing. But when season 6 of Game of Thrones came out, I would be on the edge of my bed every Sunday, like, pointing up at the sky, like, thank you, God. Like, I can't believe I tried to kill myself. I would have missed this. So after this next season, I'll have to find any reason to live. But you know, what my experience has taught me, you know, and my parents have grandparents, you know, I think about Alcoholics Anonymous and what it's done. You know, my husband and I, like, the people in my home group saw me get sober. They saw me meet my husband. They saw us, you know, they saw me pregnant. We had 100 people. It was at Tammy's house, our baby shower, our AA baby shower. We had 100 people. We did not have to buy diapers for a whole year. We don't even have to say anything. We walk into our Sunday meeting and they see our children and they know that Alcoholics Anonymous, this is what Alcoholics Anonymous does. Before Barney and Anjanae, they opened that house that I went through. Before they died, I was so, you know, I couldn't ever thank them enough, you know. But they knew, you know, they knew. Like, I look at my children and I think about what those people did for me, and how they would never take credit for it, that they would say this is what Alcoholics Anonymous does, and how my children will never know. You know, when Christmas time, well, not just Christmas time, like, they see things on TV and they're like, I want that, I want that, I want that. And you know, sometimes I think, like, oh my God, like, you don't even know how good you have it, you know. Like, like, I know, you know, women who got sober, you know, after their children were born, and they're amazing mothers, and but their stories are different. My story's different, and my kids don't have to go through the things that their kids went through, you know. And my kids don't even need to know. They don't ever have to know what it could have been like. I know who I was. I know that everything I have is by God's grace, because I didn't even want it. When it got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't want to be alive, and I let you know it. You know, when you said, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was like, I'm here because I'm not dead, you know? And that was like my way of saying, like, just get away from me, you know? And that's how I felt. I'm here because I'm not dead. I didn't want it. I didn't want any of it. I didn't want the promises. I didn't want to be happy, joyous, and free. I don't want this life. And God let me have it anyway. And that is what God's grace looks like to me, because I didn't even, you know, I just showed up and he put these people in my life to carry the message to me in the way that I needed to hear it. And they were patient and it took, and I was safe and protected in the time that I needed to learn how to live this way of life, you know, and this is the most precious gift. It's everything. It's the most important thing in my life. I'm so grateful for it. If you're here, you know, God loves you too and you have a chance, you know, so thank you very much for letting me talk.